I'm Bill Collier, Necessity of Applying a Perspective in the Science-Christianity Dialogue. Good morning. Several years ago, a very bright young theologian decided to pick up additional training in environmental science to help them formulate a modern theory of environmental stewardship. In the course of their studies, they encountered the NSF initiative to reach out to theological institutions and churches, particularly evangelical ones. The following cartoon describes their initial take on the tenure of these discussions. I'm familiar with the warfare, the complementary, the non-complementary, and the dialogue models of the interaction of science and Christian faith, which I stole straight out of one of McGrath's books. The dialogue model has the most appeal to me, but I must admit that none of these is entirely satisfactory, and that elements of all of these come into play at various times. But for a view of the interaction between science and faith, I find myself returning consistently to the writings of Michael Polanyi, whose profound thinking is marginally heard, and usually only in Christian circles, academic ones. Let me ask a quick question. How many of y'all have read a book by Michael Polanyi? Okay, so some of this... Okay, read essays, all right. Michael Polanyi, born 1891, died 1976, was the well-known Hungarian scientist on the Nobel laureate track in the scientific studies. Until he fled Germany to England to the University of Manchester to escape Hitler. There he abandoned his scientific studies, he was in the physical chemistry department there, and turned his extraordinary mental powers to the problem of why Europe destroyed itself with the disasters of World War I, World War II, and communism. He blamed it on the philosophical moral inversion that takes place in society when one tries to explain all knowledge through a lens of exact objective science that reduces all moral values and religion with a reductionist objective scientific epistemology. His explanation of the key role tacit knowledge plays in science was his underpinning and his weapon to demonstrate the absurdity of any objective science without huge tacit knowledge components. Polanyi claimed that tacit knowledge undergirds all knowledge, and because of its unspecifiable from-to character, could never be objectively formulated and described. In fact, all such attempts to do so would pervert knowledge gained from such a tacit knowledge base and lead to grievous errors in our pursuit of knowledge and truth. Tacit knowledge is a from-to knowledge where we concentrate on the focal point of seeing through the often subliminal particulars that make up the means by which we understand or perform the integrated whole on which we are focusing. Tacit knowledge can be seen in the following examples. Now, I'm probably preaching half of you, I'm probably preaching to the choir, but to some of you who have not been exposed to this, beg me this little piece here. Try to give explicit steps in precisely carefully written sequence of how you would do this. One, the line drawing of a staircase. How many of y'all are looking down on the staircase? How many of you are looking up at it? How many of you can switch between the two? Suppose you were a Kalahari Bushman who had never seen the staircase. You wouldn't see it, right? There are my two boys about 10 years ago. Suppose I take their faces. Take a good look at them. There's Justin and Andrew. Now, I add them to 500 other boys, their same age, yellow hair. And I give you a piece of paper, and I do this with my students. And I say, write in one page how you would recognize Justin and how you would recognize Andrew in careful, objective steps that you could hand to a total stranger who's never seen these two boys, and out of that 900 or 500 boys say, there's Justin, there's Andrew. Try. I guarantee you will not be able to pull it off. Usually my students get 30 seconds into it before they put the pencil down and look at me and say, what But any 2-year-old or 3-year-old can do it like that. It's personal knowledge, a classic little piece you'll see in a lot of literature. How do you learn how to read an x-ray? If we have any doctors, anybody with medical training here, would know, you do not learn to read an x-ray, or in that sense, an MRI or a CAT scan, by reading a book. You get in front of a room where you've got a bunch of people, a bunch of doctors discussing and describing things, and after being with them and interact with them, you get to the point you can do the same thing they do. It is a knowledge, and it's a knowledge that can only be transmitted by mentoring. It's a highly specific technical knowledge, but it defies written explanation if you want to be good at it. Now, let me back up here. Excuse me. Some other examples. How about trying to write a description on how to recognize your mother's voice out of 500 other different women? You can do it instantly. But how would you write it down and pass it to someone else? The whole purpose of this is to convince you that tacit knowledge is at the base of everything. If I can't sell you on that, my following arguments are not going to flow. Sight reading music. How many of y'all read an instrument? All right. You see the tune when you read the music. If you try to focus on the notes or the mechanism, you lose it. And all of you who've ever sight-readed very proficiently know you see through the music to the tune is the way you do it. Well, that's fine and dandy, but what about signs? All right, how do you put together a good experiment? Is there a book written, How to Put Together a Good Experiment? Nice general one with nice objective steps. Doesn't happen. You hang around someone who does it very well in a place called graduate school. How do you dream up or create a good hypothesis to test? How do you recognize when an experimental result is bad, particularly when one of your students and they think it's good, but you know it's bad? How do you recognize when a particular theory is bad and should be abandoned? How do you recognize when a particular theory is good and should be kept, even when most of the evidence is against it? Classic case in point is, one, plate tectonics. Sat for years before people bought it. The heliocentric theory of the solar system. Copernicus first proposed it, and it took about 100 years before it was accepted. At this point, I shall assume as a given that tacit knowledge is understood and that it undergirds all forms of empirical knowledge. If you're not fully convinced of this, then I encourage you to read Polanyi's works until his innumerable examples, both ordinary and scientific, persuade you of this reality. Take a piece of empirical knowledge, undergirding it as a piece of tacit knowledge that was used to find or discover our empirical knowledge. As we build our empirical knowledge base, we often use newly acquired tacit knowledge skills to find the new objective knowledge base. For example, when I mentored with my PhD advisor in the field of molecular spectroscopy, I acquired new tacit knowledge skills in interpreting molecular spectra that were essential to producing clear objective results. Interpreting molecular spectra often requires a type of connoisseurship that leads to one explanation of the spectrum rather than another. The choice of the next experiment to run to objectively confirm one's scientific suspicions is not given by clear objective rules, but often by an unspecifiable sense that this rather than that experiment will give us the confirmation that we need. Great scientists build their careers and skills on this type of connoisseurship and develop it greatly as they increase the objective knowledge base. Graphically, we might illustrate this as follows. Since knowledge is growing and expanding as a branch of T might represent, we see that the unspecifiable tacit knowledge components are also growing in exponential type fashion also. If this model of knowledge is correct, then we will forever have huge components of unspecifiable tacit knowledge undergirding our knowledge that will be forever beyond specific articulation. Thus, the theory of everything, where everything is known, remains unspecifiable and practically unreachable. This also illustrates why God of the Gaps arguments, in my opinion, are basically non-useful rhetoric. The unspecifiable tacit component gaps in our knowledge are not decreasing and explained by science, but are growing and increasing. It has to for our knowledge base to increase. Thus, from a Polanyian perspective, a God of the Gaps argument, I would argue, is incoherent. Polanyi raised another objection to the theory of everything, or grand unification type of scientific mindset. Let us use his words, page 143, Meanings, University of Chicago Press, 1975. Quote, "Ever since Laplace first raised the point of defining universal knowledge, philosophers have discussed the notion that from today's topography of the ultimate particles of an object, we can predict by the laws of mechanics any future topography of these particles. The immense difficulty of carrying out such computations is easily perceived. This has diverted attention from the far greater difficulty involved in the idea itself, namely that the results of such a calculation within themselves tell nothing of any importance." Moving on, saying, continuing quote, "We have seen that living beings are characterized by their physiognomies, including the space-time physiognomy of their function. A physiognomy obeys no mathematical formula. It can be recognized only by tacitly by dwelling in its numberless particulars in this way, many of them subliminal. We can know a frog only by dwelling in its particulars in this way, and we can know the topography of a frog only if we are able first to know a frog. To attribute such levels of existence as these to an atomic topography seems as absurd as it would be to talk about the smell of differential equations. Yet the modern mind seems hardly to hesitate in countenancing such incongruities. Cowed by the experience of the Copernican Revolution, we dare not trust the testimony of our senses to contradict the teachings of science." Let us modernize this a bit. The Stephen Hawkins of the future have ground out the final equation that predicts the wave function and motion of all particles in the universe. The big blue computer of the future merely grinds out the space-time coordinates of everything and the wave function at any particular point in space-time. Charlene zooms her space-time console to the planet Bart in a galaxy far, far away. Not knowing that she has discovered a planet with living things on it, she zooms in on a small 3x3-inch cube of space. There she sees the space-time coordinates of a particular location of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, iron, phosphorus, calcium, and selenium atoms. Being a biochemist who has stared at thousands of electron density maps of DNA, she recognizes DNA. From there, she quickly recognizes the electron density and wave function map of the alpha helix of a protein, and then on to various tissues. Being a good biologist who has dissected thousands of specimens and a good microscopist, she recognizes the various tissues of a living organism. However, she's also a pretty good zoologist who has specialized in aquatic animals, particularly frogs, and she knows how frogs jump and behave. "A frog," she gasps, "about to jump." But alas, our scientist Charlene is wrong, but still very close and about to discover a new type of animal. It is a hairless Bartian sith hog about to propel himself backwards by belching a large quantity of CO2 out of its mouth, thus propelling itself backwards to escape danger. Unfortunately, our scientist Charlene isn't the one at the controls. It is really Sam, the very mathematical Kalahari bushman running the console, and he has never even seen a frog, thus he sees nothing and moves the controls to something more interesting. The map is not the thing. The thing is not the map. The theory of everything is but a map. The very act of reading a topographical map to see a valley and thus navigates one's way through that valley in reality is a tacit skill that is learned by mentoring, examples, practice, and a base of tacit reading and drawing skills that boggle the imagination. To use the theory of everything to do anything requires 4,000 years of human apprenticeship, connoisseurship, tacit knowledge skills that so dwarf the equation that to apply the name theory of everything to it is absurd. Moving on. Gerald Rawl, in his book Mapping the Origins Debate, gives a fascinating diagram of origin perspectives that looks like this. Whereas we move to the right, we have increasing degrees of supernatural intervention. A scientist indwells and uses scientific training and theories to discover new novel things, much like a blind man uses a cane to find his way around. The sounds of the cane tapping and the feel of the pushback on the blind man's hand give him a myriad clues as to the ground in front of him. He indwells the cane to see his way along to new territories. The scientist indwells his taught and learned paradigm of theories to feel his or her way along to new discoveries. To the physical scientist who indwells thermodynamics, classical mechanics, electrodynamics, and quantum mechanics, etc., to understand his scientific world, the production of life from inanimate matter must be viewed from such a perspective, and it colors his view of the whole. The clash between chemical thermodynamics and chemical evolution is critical. To the biologist who first learns Linnaeus' classifications and then the Darwinian perspective, indwells their theories to see their way to new discoveries. Such a clash has little meaning to them unless viewed through the lens of evolutionary theory. Thus we see this. And this is just, it'd be interesting to do a study to see how true this is, but this is something I tend to see just among Christian scientists. And I just, it's fascinating that you could, one way you could look at it is, what theory do you indwell to understand the scientific world, and how much credence do you give to it? Let's be a little edgy, if you'll forgive me here. You are sitting on ground zero of the charismatic renewal that so influenced North American Christianities in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. A major component of that renewal was the renewed interest and experience with spiritual gifts mentioned in Acts and Corinthians, particularly glossolalia or speaking in tongues. When I discuss tacit knowledge components with Ms. Tacit Knowledge for my students at ORU, I often find them asking me if I think speaking in tongues is tacit knowledge. It's a fascinating question if pondered carefully. I personally believe glossolalia goes way beyond tacit knowledge into the spiritual realm, but it does have significant tacit knowledge components. In my own case of seeking the gift, I did not get anywhere until I focused past the mechanics or sounds of the gift and just focused intently on glorifying and worshiping God, and found as a byproduct the production of glossolalia. This is a classic Polanyian from-to tacit knowledge experience that cannot be objectively explained. Does it help me or others in my theological position to be a better scientist than we were? A very good question. I would argue that any tacit knowledge experience we become familiar with may help us in the tacit knowledge-laden experience of scientific discovery. Obviously, not everyone in Christianity or this room is going to agree with me. So let's recast the question in the more general terms. Does any legitimate, deeper spiritual life or mystical experience of a Christian believer that imbues that believer with both spiritual and tacit knowledge better enable them to pursue scientific discovery? I will argue, as long as it's coupled with a rigorous and quality scientific training, I would argue that it does. The goal of this talk was to just introduce just a few of Polanyi's ideas and their possible impact on the science-Christianity dialogue. I could go on for hours, but time is not available. What Polanyi did was to recast scientific thought in a more accurate basis, one that gave room for the essential, unknowable, unspecifiable components of human existence that includes time-tested values of truth, integrity, and what makes a modern Western tradition of freedom work. He warned that a rejection of these ideals could lead to a moral inversion, since man is a moral creature and will have morals of some sort one way or another. He claimed that it led to National Socialism, Nazism, and Communism that destroyed much of Eastern Europe. He felt that England and North America had escaped that moral inversion by pretending that the classical values of Western civilization could somehow be scientifically justified, in spite of the claims of radical skepticism. He wondered how long our civilization could hold out against these claims. In view of the crisis that Gordon College in Massachusetts went through last fall in justifying their admission policy towards homosexuals with regard to U.S. federal Pell Grant monies, I wonder also. A Polanyi perspective, if engaged correctly, can help reset any imbalance in the science-faith dialogue, because nothing stops an intellectual bully or helps a truly inquiring skeptic, as does a very good question. And with that, I invite your questions.
We've got 3 or 4 minutes for questions.
Yes. Oh, was you Dutch Schaefer?
Yeah. I like the diagram up there. I know you didn't say too much about it, but I think it is true that physical scientists tend to find arguments for evolution less compelling than do biological scientists. So I think you're onto something there.
Okay.
Bill, why don't you repeat the question, because otherwise the mic can't pick it up back there.
Let's see. Could you repeat the question for me again so I can feed it to the mic?
I was just saying I agree with your diagram.
You agree with the diagram, basically, that there tends to be a shift between Christian physical scientists and Christian biologists in terms of how they look at the origins.
Yeah, obviously lots of exceptions.
Right.
Taken in mass, I think you've got something.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir.
As I recall it, Polanyi's idea of tacit knowledge was saying, like, we know more than we can say.
Yes.
That we have these unconscious assumptions that we do not articulate. I think you were contrasting that, or it contrasts with the idea of speaking. We say more than we can know. Polanyi was saying we know more than we can say, in the sense that there are these hidden assumptions that we don't recognize that we have, but they drive a lot of our thinking, that tacit knowledge, as opposed to explicit knowledge. So I'm not sure how to make the connection.
Well, I would correct a little bit what you say. Tacit knowledge is not so much assumptions. It's more of a... when you drive a nail with a hammer, you can describe exactly the trajectory of your arm and how much force and strength and go through the physics on what it takes to hit that nail. So all of those are known objective things. But you have to see through it and practice the motion. If you try to work through it in step-by-step fashion, you'll never get there. You just go, bam.
Yeah,
you focus on the nail.
Subsidiary awareness.
Yes, subsidiary awareness. In some cases, we know what the subsidiaries are. In some cases, we don't have a clue. How do you form a sentence in your brain? We really don't have a clue how the mind goes about doing it. There's a huge, the act of speech itself, or composing a sentence in our mind in whatever language we choose, has enormous tacit components that defy any kind of specific articulation. And I guess what your question with respect was, how is it connected to what was right here?
Glossolalia.
Glossolalia. I have to get specific. In my experience is, and this is just my specific experience, was I got prayed for one time in a setting where there was a lot of pressure on me, and I was focusing on the gift, gotta get the gift, and nothing happened. And it really was a very bad experience. And with me, this was actually, I came as an undergrad to this school. And it was a much more friendly environment. A bunch of us, it was actually probably, I'm not sure, it may even, I think it was over in Zopelt. I had a bunch of friends around, we were praying, and I literally lost myself in worshiping and praising God. And I heard the guy who was praying for me back say, "Praise God, praise God." I said, "When the heck is he saying praise God over?" And I listened to myself, and I had gone and slipped into speaking in tongues. And I did not even know I had done this. And that's a classic Polanyian thing. You focus on something else, and you go through the particulars to get there. Now, I think you shouldn't necessarily restrict it to just tongues. You could go to a lot of things like that. There are a lot of spiritual experiences that a lot of people have from a lot of traditions.
We're out of time here, so sorry for your questions. You're going to have to catch Bill after. We've got 3 minutes to set up for the next person.
Thank you.